Welcome to Between the Lines. Listening to literature online. This is show number 83. One Voice from Two Worlds, Native People's Stories, Part 4. Again, reading from Genocide of the Mind, New Native American Writing, edited by Mary Jo Moore. And this section of the book is, I'll be reading from, is a lot of personal stories, each one different from the other, each wonderfully heartfelt and revealing about the individual as well as the culture. Again, there's poetry mixed in with the personal stories. And also worth noting, many of the Native people represented in the book are of mixed heritage and backgrounds. A fascinating facet of who the big we are as human beings. This is your host, Monk. Thank you for listening. Continuing on, this section is a bit longer, so it'll probably take at least a couple of shows to cover it. Some amazingly wonderful writing, as well as representing, really getting the peak feeling of the people and their stories, and just one section after the other just seems to build on the next, and in a different direction, be equally as wonderful. Here's the overview of this section by the editor, Mary Jo Moore. The section is Who We Are, Who We Are Not, Memories, Misconceptions, and Modifications. Today, after 5 centuries of Eurocentrism, most people have no idea which American Indian tribes still exist and which have been totally obliterated. Nor are they sure what traditions belong to what tribes. Over the years, the public has been inundated with various presentations of Indian stereotyping, thanks to movies and literature depicting indigenous peoples as spiritual gurus, pagan savages, Indian princesses, or pitiful burdens of society. All this always with a mishmash of tribal cultures and traditions. Fortunately, over the past decade, there has been a rising interest in the accurate depiction of Native cultures and histories, as well as present-day struggles. More and more people, Indian and non, have become interested and respectful of the truths that somehow evaded history books. Only those of Indian blood can successfully dispel the misconceptions surrounding who we are and who we are not, why and how we are not all the same. Only we can keep relating the true counts of our own personal histories, revealing disappointments as well as accomplishments, in an effort to be respected as human beings who have every right to exist in this world regardless of blood quantums, the color of our skin, or where we reside. First writer in the section, I've seen the name a lot, so I'm kind of figuring she's one of the more well-known writers, but haven't read any of her writing before. Leslie Marmon Silco of Laguna Pueblo, Cherokee, Mexican, and white ancestry, is a novelist, poet, short story writer, film writer, artist, and essayist. She grew up at Old Laguna Village on the reservation west of Albuquerque, where she was born in 1948. She's lived in the Tucson Mountains since 1978 because she likes the rattlesnakes that live under the kitchen floor of her old ranch house there. If memory serves, Laguna was one of the pueblos I visited back in the 90s, and I just remember the small little gift shop and very unassuming, out-of-the-way kind of pueblo. And that's interesting in the context of some of what Silco represents of the culture, which is highly evolved. Read about some of their views and beliefs, or what have you call it. You can see how it puts in perspective a lot of the modern day sort of mishigas about sexual identity, gender identity, all that stuff. These people, the Laguna, and a lot of the native peoples that I've heard about, they are like already, you know, they're already with this stuff. So puts it in perspective. Zilko section is Yellow Woman and a Beauty of the Spirit. And she begins, "From the time I was a small child, I was aware that I was different. I looked different from my playmates. My two sisters looked different too. We didn't look quite like the other Laguna Pueblo children, but we didn't look quite white either. In the 1880s, my great-grandfather had followed his older brothers west from Ohio to the New Mexico Territory to survey the land for the U.S. government. The two Marmon brothers came to the Laguna Pueblo Reservation because they had an Ohio cousin who already lived there. The Ohio cousin was involved in sending Indian children thousands of miles away from their families to the War Department's big Indian boarding school in Carlisle, Pennsylvania. Both brothers married full-blood Laguna Pueblo women. My great-grandfather had first married my great-grandmother's older sister, but she died in childbirth and left two small children. My great-grandmother was 15 or 20 years younger than my great-grandfather. She had attended Carlisle Indian School and spoke English beautifully." And sort of summing up the philosophy, the view here is a wonderful little bit. "A person's value lies in how that person interacts with other people, how that person behaves towards the animals and the earth. This is what matters most to the old-time people. The Pueblo people believed this long before the Puritans arrived with their notions of sin and damnation and racism. And as a thought woman and her sisters thought of it, the whole universe came into being. In this universe, there is no absolute good or absolute bad. There are only balances and harmonies that ebb and flow. Some years the desert receives abundant rain, other years there is too little rain, and sometimes there is so much rain that floods cause destruction, but rain itself is neither innocent nor guilty. The rain is simply itself." A lot of the native people's ways and traditions, over and over and over again, they remind me, or they are similar to the Tao, the flow of the Taoist philosophy, and even here with the mystical Kabbalah, when she says there's no absolute good or bad, there are only balances and harmonies. That's one of the essential principles of the tree of life, is the balance on the tree and not a good and bad deal. Now, I'm going to read a longer section here because she's talking about beauty and mentioning a Western kind of cosmetic ideal of beauty and comparing that with the Laguna. "In the old-time Pueblo world, beauty was manifested in behavior and in one's relationships with other living beings. Beauty was as much a feeling of harmony as it was a visual, oral, or sensual effect. The whole person had to be beautiful, not just the face or the body. Faces and bodies could not be separated from hearts and souls. Health was foremost in achieving this sense of well-being and harmony. In the old-time Pueblo world, a person who did not look healthy inspired feelings of worry and anxiety, not feelings of well-being. A healthy person, of course, is in harmony with the world around her. She is at peace with herself, too. Thus, an unhappy person or spiteful person would not be considered beautiful. In the old days, strong, sturdy women were most admired. One of my most vivid preschool memories is of the crew of Laguna women in their 40s and 50s who came to cover our house with adobe plaster. They handled the ladders with great ease, and while two women ground the adobe mud on the stones and added straw, another woman loaded the hod with mud and passed it up to the two women on ladders who were smoothing the plaster on the wall with their hands. Since women owned the houses, they did the plastering. At Laguna, men did the basket making and the weaving of fine textiles. Men helped a great deal with the child care, too. Because the creator is female, there is no stigma on being female. Gender is not used to control behavior. No job was a man's job or a woman's job. The most able person did the work. My grandma Lily had been a Ford Model A mechanic when she was a teenager. I remember when I was young, she was always fixing broken lamps and appliances. She was small and wiry, but she could lift her weight in rolled roofing or boxes of nails. When she was 75, she was still repairing washing machines in my uncle's coin-operated laundry. The old-time people paid no attention to birthdays. When a person was ready to do something, she did it. When she no longer was able, she stopped. Thus, the traditional Pueblo people did not worry about aging or about looking old because there were no social boundaries drawn by the passage of years. It was not remarkable for young men to marry women as old as their mothers. I never heard anyone talk about women's work until after I left Laguna for college. Work was there to be done by any able-bodied person who wanted to do it. At the same time, in the old-time Pueblo world, identity was acknowledged to be always in a flux. In the old stories, one minute Spider-Woman is a little spider under a yucca plant, and the next instant she is a sprightly grandmother walking down the road. When I was growing up, there was a young man from a nearby village who wore nail polish and women's blouses and permed his hair. People paid little attention to his appearance. He was always part of a group of young men from his village. No one ever made fun of him. Pueblo communities were and still are very interdependent, but they have always have to be tolerant of individual eccentricities because survival of the group means everyone has to cooperate. In the old Pueblo world, differences were celebrated as signs of the Mother Creator's grace. Persons born with physical or sexual differences were highly respected and honored because their differences gave them special positions as mediators between this world and the spirit world. The great Navajo medicine man of the 1920s, the Crawler, had a hunchback and could not walk upright, but he was able to heal even the most difficult cases. And a little bit farther on, in the sacred Kiva ceremonies, men mask and dress as women to pay homage and to be possessed by the female energies of the spirit beings. Because differences in physical appearances were so highly valued, surgery to change one's face and body to resemble a model's face and body would be unimaginable. To be different, to be unique, was blessed and was best of all. To demonstrate sisterhood and brotherhood with plants and animals, the old-time people make masks and costumes that transform the human figures of the dancers into the animal beings they portray. Every impulse is to reaffirm the urgent relationships that human beings have with the plant and animal world. And some of the mythology. We children were always warned not to harm frogs or toads, the beloved children of the rain clouds, because terrible floods would occur. I remember in the summer, the old folks used to stick big balls of cotton on the outside of their screen doors as bait to keep the flies from going in the house when the door was opened. The old folks staunchly resisted the killing of flies because once, long, long ago, when human beings were in a great deal of trouble, a green bottle fly carried the desperate messages of human beings to the Mother Creator in the fourth world below this one. Human beings had outraged the Mother Creator by neglecting the Mother Corn altar while they dabbled with sorcery and magic. The Mother Creator disappeared, and with her disappeared the rain clouds and the plants and the animals too. The people began to starve, and they had no way of reaching the Mother Creator down below. Green Bottle Fly took the message to the Mother Creator, and the people were saved. To show their gratitude, the old folks refused to kill any flies. The old stories demonstrate the interrelationships that the Pueblo people have maintained with their plant and animal clans people. Cochininaco, yellow woman, represents all women in the old stories. In one story, the people are suffering during a great drought and accompanying famine. Each day, Cochininaco has to walk farther and farther from the village to find fresh water for her husband and children. One day, she travels far, far to the east. to the plains, and she finally locates a fresh water spring. But when she reaches the pool, the water is churning violently, as if something large had just gotten out of the pool. Kochininako does not want to see what huge creature had been at the pool, but just as she fills her water jar and turns to hurry away, a strong, sexy man in buffalo skin leggings appears by the pool. Little drops of water glisten on his chest. She cannot help but look at him because he is so strong and so good to look at. Able to transform himself from human to buffalo in the wink of an eye, Buffalo Man gallops away with her on his back. Kochininako falls in love with Buffalo Man, and because of this liaison, the buffalo people agree to give their bodies to the hunters to feed the starving pueblo. Thus, Kochininako's fearless sensuality results in the salvation of the people of her village, who are saved by the meat the buffalo people give to them. In another story, Kochininako has a fling with Whirlwind Man and returns to her husband 10 months later with twin baby boys. Twin boys grow up to be great heroes of the people. Once again, Kochininako's vibrant sexuality benefits her people. The stories about Kochininako, hopefully I pronounced that right, made me aware that sometimes an individual must act despite disapproval or concern for appearances, or what others may say. From Yellow Woman's adventures, I learned to be comfortable with my differences. I even imagined that Yellow Woman had yellow skin, brown hair, and green eyes like mine, although her name does not refer to her color, but rather to the ritual color of the East. So there's not only the female creator is fascinating there, but the archetypal, the mythological Yellow Woman that represents, you know, all kinds of levels of beauty and uses her sensuality in a way that helps the people. So quite the different role model there. Yeah, I'm going to read a poem by, and a name you would not expect in this book, Molly McGlennon. It is of mixed heritage. Anishinaab, A-N-I-S-H-I-N-A-A-B-E, French and Irish, raised in Minneapolis, Minnesota. MFA in creative writing from Mills College, and at this time of the book was pursuing PhD in Native American Studies at the University of California, Davis. Her dissertation on 4 contemporary female Native poets. As a little introduction to the poem. Simultaneously, poet, mixed blood, granddaughter. The blur of blood and lilac, the unforgettable smells of a Minnesota summer. Wore my swimsuit from June 1 until the night before third grade, where I first heard S. Winner's 1868 Ten Little Injuns comic song and chorus. Two little Injuns fooling with a gun, one shot the other, and then there was none. I stand in ankle-deep water, the beginning of color, and sing my version. Ten Little Indians. One is a troubled breed, traces bloodlines to Anishinaab grandmother with her right hand, a French grandfather with her left. Two, never knows what box to check. Used to go to mass every Sunday with blue jeans and a t-shirt. Three, has blue eyes and an Irish name. Wrote her first poem in the 8th grade and got a C. Four, occupies 2 homes, one where she sleeps at night and one is memorized landscape arrowheads she found around the bluff. Five, loves to swim the lakes of her childhood. Water she knows by heart. Has never told the secret of her hands, their sculling. 6. Shoots baskets with her brother in the alley until the crickets come out. 7. Dances salsa and tries to speak Spanish. Legs like her aunts and grandma, she saves the holy cards they send her. 8. Helps her mother cook wild rice. Has known the recipe, never spoken since she was small. Her hair pulled into a ponytail. 9. Resists explaining herself every time someone asks, "So, what are you anyway?" 10. Takes her time, slowly. Is careful not to be understood. Then after the poem, now bar patrons ask me, what are you? The room moves with iconic delineations of who I am supposed to be. My identity is emotion, both the midnight and blinding white of blue. This happens all too often, locally, globally. And another piece that is a poem, a longish poem by Tim Hayes. Ho-Chunk is the first American Indian pianist to play solo recitals at both the Institute of American Indian Arts in Santa Fe and the American Indian Community House in New York. Born and raised in Nebraska, he began piano studies at 13 and at 17 played the Ravel G Major Concerto with the Omaha Symphony. He has played various concerts in the New York area, including for the American Landmark Festival Series and at the Cathedral of St. John the Divine, and worked with the Zurich Opera in Switzerland and in France. Active as both a Native cultural worker and chamber musician at the time of this book, residing in Brooklyn, New York. Manitowoc Spirit Place in Anishinaabe. Well, Molly McGlennon's title was She's Nothing Like We Thought. This is Tim Hayes, Manitowoc Spirit Place in Anishinaabe. It starts off with a kind of note and then goes into the poem for Calvin and Judy in Chicago. Note: the Field Museum of Natural History in Chicago houses the remains of more than 40,000 indigenous people. This does not include other entities that have been or are still alive: Kachina dolls, flutes, drums, headwear, and ceremonial instruments from holy people. Many of these bodies were donations for the 1892 Columbian Exposition and the World Parliament of Religions making first contact in this hemisphere. Indigenous people were excluded from this event. To the voices of the ancient ones, now long unheard, I stand by a secure glass case, a display. An ancient voice composed of wood, eyes a mouth, smooth, soft in appearance. I am full of wonder, awe, enchantment at this magic flute. But in this great temple to Western ideology, this one ancient voice has been silenced, as a tongue cut out, displaced, lost, fury in grief, rage in despair. This voice has been coated, covered, violated, suffocated by scientists' poison, a resin made to preserve the skin of this one ancient voice. Toxins cover the wood, not allowing any one person, being, to breathe life into the flute, as it is poisonous to human touch. As the Western mind preserves identity, culture, mind, and lack of world view, this one ancient one is quiet, grieving, silenced. I wonder, is its thought dead because he/she cannot speak by its own will or volition? Would she/he live again, and could he/she sing and tell who was serenaded, quiet, passion, focused seduction of generations of ancestors who made love to her, his voice, and who venerated this place rather than time, as one continuous living connection. I marvel, do the ancient ones play in voices, sounds, tones, songs that are unheard to deaf Western ears? Do they, the ancient ones, speak? Will I of this future generation be allowed to become an ancient one, or will my being wander in discomfort, an entity studied, examined, dissected by Western minds and housed in a glass case? I am an ancient one. Ancient ancestors walk with me, generations of healing, teaching, guiding. Spirit beings watch me, love me, carry me. This one ancient voice and her, his, her voice, I can hear. I am not deaf to the unheard songs that Western minds do not understand. And let's see, one more section. This is by a gentleman, David Bunn-Martin, Shinnecock, Montauk, Algonquin. Not sure the pronunciation. Nednai Chiricahua Apache, and of Hungarian descent, is from the Shinnecock Indian Reservation near Southampton, Long Island. David has worked in tribal government, education, and the museum profession during the past 20 years. He is a professional painter, woodcarver, illustrator, and a current board member of Amerinda. And actually have met David and know him a little bit. He's a wonderful person, and the Shinnecock Museum is a real treasure in Southampton. A lot of the artwork, there are tons of portraits he has done of family members, elders, Shinnecock people. That's really it's like a painting photo gallery of history, and he's got some huge wall murals depicting thousands of years ago, the different rituals and gatherings, and so it's really a fascinating place to go if you're in the area. I strongly recommend it. And the Shinnecock Nation, they trace their ancestry on Long Island 10 to 12,000 years back. Reading it in a Shinnecock book, their name for the island is Shell Place or Shell Heaven, Siwanhaki, however it's pronounced, I don't know, but that is my preferred now version of what the name of Long Island is. Palmanok is another word that Whitman made well known, but that means land of tribute, as a certain amount of taxes were paid to smaller Indians paying taxes to larger Indians in the gist of it. And so the shell place, shell heaven, honors the shells themselves and doesn't have that economical governmental twist to it. So David's got a fascinating history, fascinating background, and some poems in here too. This section is pyramids, art, museums, and bones, some brief memories. I've always been involved in the arts, my mother being a classical opera singer and artist, and Chiricahua Apache, my father a Hungarian pianist voice teacher, whose own father designed the Vatican Embassy in Budapest. Grandmother, a Shinnecock Montauk Indian by whom I was raised on the reservation, loved to read European history and do beadwork taught to her by my grandfather. It was natural, therefore, for me to be interested in history, mostly American and Native American music and art. I had three great-grandfathers on my mother's side who remained vividly in my mind's eye, all of whom I never met. The first one, named Chin Chi, was a well-known Chiricahua Apache warrior who was killed 2 weeks before Geronimo's final surrender in Mexico in 1886, whereupon his wife, my great-grandmother Kaga Ashen, married Old Martin, a very tough ex-warrior turned U.S. Army scout, who, with a cousin, helped persuade Geronimo to surrender. I grew up with stories only the family knew concerning the Apache Wars and the years of Geronimo's imprisonment at Fort Sill, Oklahoma. The tales of ancestors such as Victorio, Mangas Coloradas, Nana, Chato, and Cochise have always loomed large in my imagination. My other great-grandfather was named Charles Sumner Bunn. He was a professional guide and hunter and farmer from eastern Long Island, whose Algonquin ancestors, Shinnecock and Montauk, are from an ancient stock documented to nearly 10,000 years in this area and were offshore whalers from dugout canoes before the English arrived. He was a well-respected elder, leader, and also a prolific woodcarver of duck decoys. The culture had been a product of 300 years of coexistence with first the Dutch, then the English colonial settlers. His father was a first mate on whaling ships that went around the world, finally drowning with 10 other men of the tribe during a salvage operation in the Atlantic near Long Island on a ship called Circassian, ironically, in 1876. Some of his hunting clients were interesting people such as Kermit and Quentin Roosevelt, sons of Teddy, Christian Herder, a former Secretary of State, and many other wealthy businessmen and politicians who vacationed on Long Island's East End at the turn of the last century. History such as this colored my perceptions in childhood, which was rich, varied, and flavored by both the Indian and white worlds. I was raised with the idea that Indian culture was just as dignified, important, and great as any other culture. The juxtaposition of Indian culture and European or American culture easily coexisted in our household. Music and spirituality have always been a part of my world, a part of the understanding of living simultaneously in two worlds. My mother took voice lessons for years, gave many concerts, and was one of the few Indians in classical music at that time. I was raised in the Protestant Christian tradition, though fully respected and admired the traditional Indian spirituality. Aware that we had medicine people in the Apache side of the family, I also began studying the mysticism of India and other esoteric wisdom traditions. During the 1950s, my family appeared on several TV shows. My grandmother described the history of being depicted in the then new movie called Apache with Burt Lancaster and Gene Peters. This was a movie about the last days of the Geronimo War and was quite accurate and sympathetic toward the Indian cause for the time. Grandpa and mother sang Apache songs with Steve Allen, Ernie Kovacs, and Dave Garraway. My grandpa had been comfortable as a lecturer and performer since his days before 1920 at the Hampstead Institute in Virginia. He was a traditional Chiricahua, yet was very comfortable interacting with other Indian cultures and the white man's world as well. The family also took part in powwows and operated a gift shop called Teepee in the Hills Indian Trading Post, where they made everything they sold. And he goes on, this one little section here to give a feel for, I think he's still the director, or cultural director of the museum, so he's got a lot of experience in museum training and all that. And the area is talking about dealing with various remains that, things that get into a museum, like clothing or moccasins or medicine bundles. And he's talking about working with the non-natives. There did seem to be a lack of any kind of spirituality connected with the handling of the material or any spiritual feeling shown by most members of the non-Indian staff, though they tried to be as respectful as they could. The prevailing attitude was usually the superior position of science and the scientific imperative. Sometimes one could detect a patronizing attitude with regard to our beliefs. I don't think it was conscious behavior, but I personally feel that society at large has lost the feeling of the sacred in whatever belief system they might subscribe to. Therefore, I was not really surprised, but disheartened at the lack of such appreciation of the sacred when dealing with the Indian materials in this institutional setting. This did manifest as occasional strain in staff relationships between native and non-native staff. It also presented difficulties among the Indian staff as well. All in all, working in Indian museums can be a wonderful experience if done with respect and awareness of the unique characteristics of the collections and cultures represented. I'll read two of his poems, and that'll wrap up this show. The first one is called Shinnecock Whalers. Now, the whale, that was the whale to the Shinnecock is akin to the buffalo to the Plains Indians and the Lakota. So this is the poem Shinnecock Whalers. Behemoths, they were to ride the waves. Into the breakers and currents they came. Since time immemorial, from dawn to dusk, the whales swam by unstoppable thrust. When to the shore he floundered and sank, they came close by, sacred body to thank. Great gift of God, creator spirit were they, the behemoths and great fish of the bay. Into canoes of tulip and oak, Shinnecock men navigated the stroke. Through wave and shoals they pulled the trees, finally carved vessels of wood and dreams. Fins and tails, they said long ago, were considered holy, from nature on loan. Fearless and reverent Shinnecock men they were, who venerated nature, the spirit to stir. Then manning the crews aboard whaling ships, they sailed seven seas at a furious clip, among 3 years' time sailing the great vessels to process and harvest the whales they wrestled. Until at last it no longer paid for whalers to sail amidst storm and hail. Whales they did kill in great numbers long before oil and blubber disappointed the throng. Oil it was which took their place. Black gold was used to fuel the race. All whaling ceased by the ancient ways of years sailing, toiling, oceans and bays. And Apache Mountain Spirits, the Chiricahuas have a dance, but it is more than a dance. It is four men painted in soot and ash, whose base is for celestial pattern in white, of moons and stars, of rainbows and mountains, of slicing lightning cracking through the deep darkness of the evening sky. It is the bonfire tall as a white pine, roaring to life with the substance of gold and orange crackle and hot with the heat of 100 blast furnaces. It is the round clearing symbol of the cycles of cosmos around which the people dance, side to side or one behind each, offering the life within all. It is the mystical move of the deer and horns, the headpieces and masks and swords of the protectors, the avengers who avenge the affront of the light by foe of darkness. It is the slash and spin of their movements, the jagged posturing grace of other worldly souls sent as guardians to the people. It is the songs of the singers and their drums, drumming the chant of the soil and the flowers, the spirits of yesterday and the spirits of 1,000 years ago. It is the powerful songs, it is the ancient songs, which underscore all creation as the heartbeat of earth and sky and the giver of life. Not much to say after hearing some lovely poetry. Thank you so much for listening. Have a good one. And we'll go out with a track. I'm not sure where the music's from, but it's about a 5-minute video on YouTube of the Shinnecock Nation powwow, which has some wonderful dancing. And this is the music that's played with it. I don't know if it was actually played at the time or imposed. I'm not sure where it's from, but it is bouncy, interesting, and put the link on the notes page. It's worth checking out the dancers.
Yeah.